This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Ben Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 5, Diagon Alley.
Ooh,
man.
We are officially, like, in the wizarding world.
We are there. We are, like, entering in. But before we get into the wizarding world, I just want to say thank you to all of our listeners out there, because, like, as of recording this, it is the week after the podcast has officially launched, and we've just sort of been looking at the numbers every day. Like, as of this morning, we were ranked number 67.
67, yeah. On the overall Spotify chart.
On the overall Spotify chart. So that's amazing. So thank you so much to everyone who's listening out there. I could not believe it. I think my wife was like nerding out too when she texted me. It's like, you guys are number 2 on the Apple Books charts and number 7 in the arts charts. So maybe it was number 3. I don't know. But it was all, I was just like, what is happening? That's so cool.
Just a really great feeling. So it's so exciting to see like everybody tuning in and being excited about the new show, which just makes us that much more excited to kind of keep the ball rolling here with Chapter 5, Diagon Alley, where we wake up in the hut on the rock, out in the middle of sea.
This chapter is loaded with things that happened. Like, I went down to do like a little summary, and I was like, oh yeah, this happened. So here's everything, just a quick breakdown of everything that happens off the cuff. Is they leave the hut on the rock, go to Diagon Alley, meet Professor Quirrell, visit Gringotts for the first time, get the Sorcerer's Stone, meet Malfoy, buy Hedwig, and Harry gets his wand.
It's a lot.
So, like, much happens.
In a lot of ways, I feel like Harry getting his wand by itself could be its own chapter.
Oh my gosh. You know, it could have been like, oh, only one thing left, Harry. We got to get your wand. Chapter 6, The Wand Maker.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, it's just like a quietly short chapter, but that's not really how these books work. Like, there's a lot. At any given point in time, I feel like several chapters could be, or one chapter could be several chapters. But yeah.
This is like a real symptom of Philosopher's Stone, too, where like it is a much shorter book. And like the end result is that every chapter is packed with like a lot of different things happening.
There is, and the other theme that continued, and I'll try to spot them as I go, is that I feel like these early first 5 chapters or so are just absolutely cram-packed with obscure little trivia facts that
come back in such big ways later on.
Yes, it's wild.
I was like, oh, this comes back. There's so many, and like the first 5 chapters of Philosopher's Stone, they set up so many things for Deathly Hallows.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yep. So, but yeah, the chapter kicks off with Harry sort of like in this half dreamlike state, where he's kind of got that like dreadful, crushing feeling, which is that like it was just all a dream. That must be the case. Like, I dreamed that I was a wizard and that I was going to get to be taken away, and like this will all be better. Which always brings about one of my favorite questions, which is just simply, is it better or worse to wake up from a good dream or a bad dream?
Oh,
it's
right.
Like when you wake up from a good dream and you're like, oh, it was just a dream.
Oh, man.
But then you like wake up from a bad dream and you're still stressed from everything you just felt inside of the bad dream.
I know. If you wake up from a good dream, you're like, oh, God, I just wish I was still dreaming. There's no good answer.
I know. Yeah. So it's either which way, but I relate to Harry's sensation there. Like, I feel I've had that on so many occasions where you wake up and you're like, oh, is this a dream?
Yeah. So I think it's interesting because he says when he's imagining that he's going to wake up and it's going to have all been a dream, he says, I'll wake up at home in my cupboard, which to me, it's like, so at this point, he's already gotten the new room too.
Oh, that's
so
true. Yeah.
In his mind, the dream has consisted of not just Hagrid showing up and telling him he's a wizard, but also the letters arriving and all, and him getting a new room and stuff like that. All of it's been a dream.
All of it's been a dream. Yeah. I know. Yeah. So he's going way back.
He's going way back.
I've been out for a minute.
I'm not even 11 yet. Jeez.
Yep. Yep. Right away though, we see owl mail kind of coming into effect with the delivery of the Daily Prophet, which is kind of like one of those just funny exchanges where, Hagrid's like, there's money in my coat.
Yeah.
Look in the pockets. And then like his coat is just like full of pockets.
Yeah.
Which once again is like one of these things where, we're big fans of the story Name of the Wind, where cloaks with pockets are like always regarded as a good thing.
Yeah. Is that just like a fantasy trope? Just like, someone has a coat with that's mostly just pockets.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it seems like Hagrid's coat is exactly that.
So Hagrid's coat is that. Yeah.
That's like one of those things. I always remembered it, and I don't know why. I always remembered it as if the delivery for the Daily Prophet was a single canut. So when I saw 5 canuts, I was like, man, it's expensive to take out a subscription here.
Or is it? I mean, it's the money in this chapter. I mean, money in the Wizarding World is always
easy enough.
What's so infuriating is that later in this chapter, Hagrid's explaining the base 17 currency system they have going. It's like 29? 29 nuts to a sickle, 17 sickles to a galleon?
Yes.
First of all, that doesn't make sense at all. They're not even divisible. You've used two different prime numbers, Wizarding World. That's bananas. But at the same time, Hagrid is having trouble figuring out the muggle money. And it's like, whatever they say that, I'm like, I don't understand. Because it's just numbers. What are you not understanding? You use the same numbers.
It's funny though, because I'm also reading Project Hail Mary at the same time, and there's just this tiny little sequence where it talks about the fact that humans operate in base 10, and the only reason we operate in base 10 at all is just simply because we have 10 fingers.
Yes. Yeah.
And so like that is like one of those things where it's like we see 10 as a round number because that's how we've been taught,
right,
from the very beginning. So who knows? Maybe if you just always learned currency this way, maybe.
But at the same rate though, it's like we have a base 10. We use that, but then like our measurement system is not. We use like 12 inches, and it's like that continues to be baffling the whole time.
Oh yeah. That's just entirely confusing. Yeah. So, but I also feel like this is part of like the irregularity. Like we talked about it in one of the earlier chapters, but it's sort of like how Petunia has this like obsession with like overly cleanliness, and it feels like part of like what the charm of the Wizarding World is that it is a bit messy.
Yeah.
And nothing is that much messier than prime numbers.
That I do like that explanation for it. That there's something like magical about the complete nonsense of the currency system.
That's my subscription.
I like that.
I think I buy into that.
That's
absolutely
a little bit better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So things in his pockets. I thought this was interesting. It lists slug pellets, bunches of keys, balls of string, and peppermint humbugs, which just stood out to me because just yesterday, as we're recording this, we did a trivia show where one of the questions was, what is the one thing Harry doesn't touch at the Hogwarts feast? And it's peppermint humbugs, which makes it sound like peppermint humbugs are a wizard thing that they're serving at Hogwarts. So I feel like this is maybe just like one of those tiny mistakes where it's like Harry shouldn't be able to identify what a peppermint humbug is yet.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
So this would be a question.
Or is it a British thing?
I was going to say, or just a question for British listeners is are peppermint humbugs more similar to like your classic like peppermint hard candy that's sort of like the white circle with like the like little red stripes along the edges?
Right.
Because that's something I've never considered before, but peppermint humbugs does come across to me as seeming more magical, but you're right. Like Harry couldn't have identified peppermint humbugs.
Right, because he doesn't know anything yet. He can't even identify the canuts.
Okay, so there's that. Okay. I don't want to jump too far forward, but I did, there is like one money related, it's not really an error, but it's kind of like a funny little like slip up. And I caught it because I both read and listened to the chapter. And at one point as they're in Diagon Alley, someone is shaking their head as they're passing by saying dragon liver, 16 sickles to an ounce, they're mad. In the audiobook, it actually says 17 sickles to an ounce.
Oh, whoops.
Yeah, which is funny because...
just because that'd be one galleon.
It's the same as saying like, that would be the same as like going to a vending machine for like a soft drink and being like, it cost 100 cents.
Yeah.
instead of like $1. So I was like, that's really funny because my copy of the book says 16 sickles. So it's clearly been corrected.
Yeah.
However... At whatever time Jim Dale recorded it, it's at 17. So I was like, that's pretty funny.
That is pretty funny. I like that. Little, good catch. Good catch.
Thank you. Thank you.
Man, okay. So going on with money, Harry realized, first of all, I love as they're leaving the hut on the rock, there's just a couple of things about it. Is that one, they completely, there's no goodbye to the Dursleys at all.
Oh, which I never have caught that before. Yeah, and I know. Like, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I'm like, were they still there? Like, did they leave? It's like, no, they're still there. They just get up and leave. They don't even talk to them at all, which I think is hilarious. And then they go outside and Hagrid's like, oh yeah, we'll have to take this boat. I was allowed to do a little magic to get here. And Harry's like, how'd you get here? And he says, flew, which is like not helpful. And this is one of those things where whether you're listening to it or reading it, maybe there could be some confusion because just the word flew as a form of travel might be F-L-O-O, like flu powder, which obviously Hagrid didn't use anyway because he would have come in through the fireplace if that was the case. But what he means is F-L-E-W, flew, which is also just a giant question mark because like... How did you fly? I think Hagrid specifically at one point later on in the series says that, you know, there's no broomstick that could hold it, that could hold me. Like, just look at me, you know?
The only thing, because I literally remember, wait, what? And then I was like, Thestrals, maybe?
But then why wouldn't he keep the Thestral there?
Well, you could, but it would be invisible. So I don't know, like, to Harry? It would be invisible to Harry at this point in time.
That's
so, like.
That's interesting. But that's.
So it technically could still be there.
It could still be there.
The other thing about Thestrals is they have an excellent sense of direction. So like if all Hagrid had told them was I need to go find Harry Potter, similar to owls, it should have been able to do so.
Dude, I love that. I had not considered Thestrals. So I was like, Hagrid, there's no way Hagrid can fly. Like he can't ride on a broom. He didn't use the motorbike. Like, and if he can fly, then he can do insanely powerful magic because that's like a Voldemort signature thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's that. Dude, you're right.
Yeah. It is 1,000% a Thestral, which is just still invisible and just flies its way back.
You want to know what else is so cool about this that makes it doubly awesome is the fact that they normally, when you get to school as your first year, you take a boat, which is what they end up doing, but past your first year, you're in the Thestral-drawn carriages.
Yeah.
So, like, the two ways that Hagrid enters and exits are the two ways that you might approach Hogwarts Castle. Yeah. So it's
enters on the Thestral, exit on the boat. I also love that they take the boat because it means they just strand the Dursleys there. And, like, they don't have cell phones. And the whole point of this place is that it is remote. So how do they get off the island? No idea. I guess the guy who rented the house to them eventually is like, I really want my boat back. I'll have to come in my other boat. Oh, your son's got a tail. That's weird.
It's just a real shocker for that man.
And yet they must get off pretty quickly because Hagrid and Harry are only gone for the rest of this one day, at which point Harry returns to the Dursleys at number 4 Privet Drive. So they get off the island?
That makes me think that it must be the case that somehow Hagrid re-delivered the boat back to him. Like
just
possibly like
rocketed it back?
Yeah, like unmanned, sort of like sent it backwards. Because you're right, like this is one of those big deviations from the films where when Harry normally goes with Hagrid, he goes and spends his whole day, but he never goes back to the Dursleys. Hagrid just like literally is like, and here's your ticket, good luck at school. And then that's just it. But in this case, Harry has to go back to the Dursleys for a full month before he gets
there for a while.
Yeah, eventually boarding the
Hogwarts Express. I'm reading the section again, though. He says flu, but then he says, yeah, but we'll go back in this. I'm not supposed to use magic now. I've got you. And it's like, but you wouldn't have had to have used magic to fly on a Thestral.
But I still think Harry couldn't see it, so Harry, I don't know if that could be off-putting or something.
It absolutely could be. All right. Yeah, I'm still going with Thestral. That's got to be it.
Yeah, but then we get like a little bit more of like how much can we rely on everything that Hagrid says a couple paragraphs later where he starts talking about how like Harry's concerned because he doesn't have any money and Hagrid's basically like, oh, don't worry, you have plenty at Gringotts. We're going to go there today. And he's like, you know, explaining it, you know, and saying like there's no place safer and stuff like that. But then he says Gringotts is hundreds of miles under London. And it's like,
hundreds of miles.
I'm sorry. Hundreds is too many. And so I was curious. I was like, how, I don't even, I mean, this is like one of those things where it's like, I don't know off the top of my head how many miles it is to the center of the earth, but I started just doing like some reading just to be like, you know, if you were hundreds of miles under the earth, then what would like the relative temperature be? Because at some point in time, you go from like the standard temperature underground, which I think like in a cave is like 56 or 57 degrees or something like that. We've done some caving in our day. But then, you know, obviously the further that you go, it starts to get hotter and hotter and hotter. After a certain distance, it's like 8 degrees hotter every extra mile you go or something like that. Anyway, so it wouldn't be intolerably hot at 100 miles, but it would be hotter.
Yeah.
The other thing that I learned is just how squashed our planet actually is, because when you're standing on the equator, you're actually a lot further from the center of the earth than you are when you're standing on like one of the north or south poles.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like considerably. Like
it's more of an egg?
It's more, yeah, it's like more of like a squished, it's yeah, like a squished egg or something.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, I just learned something about our planet.
Ben's an egg earther. I love that he says, yeah, they set up like right away. One of the first things he tells them about Gringotts is, yeah, so you'd be mad to try and rob it. And it's like that they basically just set up, well, not only the like the events of this book, but also the events of Deathly Hallows, when sure enough, Harry has to try and rob it. And he says, never mess with goblins. And it's like, well, Harry is going to mess with goblins at some point.
Yeah, he thinks that there could be a dragon. He's heard rumor of that. And that we know that we eventually will learn that there is, in fact, a dragon down there.
Yes, yes, indeed. Okay, this is something I thought, I was like, I noticed this for the first time as we were reading through it. He says, you got to find your way. Gringotts is hundreds of miles under London Sea, deep under the underground. Okay, maybe I read that wrong. But in any case, Dumbledore in chapter one says that he has a map of the London Underground on like his leg as like a scar or something.
Yep.
Which is like, and then I was like, which I've always just assumed was like the subway system.
Yeah, I believe London. That is. Yep, yep.
Yeah, but then I was reading this and I was like, I wonder if what he actually has is a map of like Gringotts scarred on his leg.
Oh, that would have been, if all he had said was deep underground or something. Yeah. Like, yeah, but deep no, but he's under the underground.
Under the underground, so yeah, never mind. Forget that.
Right.
My bad.
The next little thing we get here, though, was the Ministry of Magic messing things up as usual.
Oh, I know. They're just introduced as this fumbling government.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Absolutely, like, right away. And it's kind of like one of those things where it's like, you know, he, like, Cornelius Fudge gets the job, but, like, he's referred to as a bungler,
yeah,
which is a term I've never heard before. Well, apparently I have because I've read the story so many times, but it never comes to mind when I think of a go-to insult for somebody. But he pelts Dumbledore with owls every morning asking for advice. This is kind of like one of those things where it's like, did you just trip on your own logic a little bit, Hagrid? Like, if he's always asking Dumbledore for advice, and Dumbledore, I mean, assuming Dumbledore is providing said advice, then you would think that the Ministry of Magic wouldn't always be messing things up as usual, because Fudge would just be doing whatever Dumbledore told him to do.
I want to know what they're doing that's messing things up, because he just says Ministry is messing things up as usual, but like with no context. And it's like, in this book, they don't really specifically do anything wrong that we know of.
Uh-huh.
Like, clearly they are bumbling and they make all sorts of mistakes moving forward. But like that, there's like, I wonder what happened on this particular day.
That's an interesting question. Yeah. So I guess we'll have to keep that like burning in the back of our brain and see if we end up finding some explanation as to what would be going on, because we know that the events of this very day are about to make some headlines.
Yes, they are.
But we don't know of anything happening prior to this very day that would do the same. So anyway, yeah, we make our way to London, which Harry has never been to before, which I know is kind of like one of those things, like when they go to the zoo for Dudley's birthday, it just simply means they didn't go to the London Zoo because Harry has never been to London before.
Oh, right. Yeah. So we can just rule that out.
You can just rule that out. So it went to some other zoo, not the London Zoo.
There's all sorts of like weird little things like that. Or like, this is another one that I think is odd, is that like they talk about, this is moving forward a Chamber of Secrets, but like they talk about like going to find the Ford Angley in the parking lot at, you know, King's Cross, and it's like King's Cross does not have a parking lot at all.
Yeah, it's like
it's just in the middle of the city.
Right. You need to wait for the car to be there.
Yeah, it's cool. Whatever.
Yeah,
yeah. We can move right past that.
Right. One of the things I like that they set up early is Hagrid's love of dragons. Crikey, I love a dragon, and I like the use of the word crikey here, because it is like a classic like Steve Irwin exclamatory.
Yeah,
and Steve Irwin, of course, was like a big animal guy. Obviously, it's the primary thing he game he's known for. So I love the use of the word crikey, just simply because I have always assumed crikey to be an Australian word, but Hagrid also loves beasts. So his use of it
is
here,
it a beast word?
Yeah, is this like a beast or like a little, is it like a Steve Irwin reference possibly?
I don't know.
I found that to be kind of fun.
I
know.
I love that he says, I wanted one ever since I was a kid. And it's like, oh, but, and you know what? Didn't get too settled for a giant spider. So there's that.
Yep. We know that much.
Moving on.
We get the Hagrid getting on the subway and knitting what looks like a yellow circus tent.
Yeah. Like, what's he making?
Yeah. This is like, you know, Hagrid is known, like, you know, in the future for his like baking and like, you know, kind of like engaging in like lots of like little things that feel like juxtapositions for like this big
right.
Like, you know, like character. But so I love just the image of him knitting here. Interestingly though, I have actually read a little bit before about this because we never learn in the books specifically which house Hagrid was in. And I have seen before a lot of speculation based on this particular line that because he's knitting in yellow, that Hagrid was actually a Hufflepuff, which is also kind of interesting because you get the line where Harry is ultimately asking about like the specific houses.
Yeah.
And like, I think Hagrid says like, everyone says Hufflepuff's a bunch of like duffers, but, and then like, I think like, like Harry cuts him off at like that point in time or something. So it's like, was Hagrid about to be like, but I was one. So but,
yeah. Right. You know? So there's that. Yeah. I think it's one of those things on Pottermore. He's confirmed to have been in Gryffindor.
That is correct.
But boy, oh boy, we can get to this later. I don't buy it at all. I think Hagrid was in Slytherin, man.
It seems like there's a very real possibility.
So much evidence that Hagrid was in Slytherin, and it is just there's just no way he was. If that's what they say, then maybe that's the case. But there's a so much Slytherin.
We have a strong argument for, but we'll save that.
We'll save that one. Yeah. We're getting way ahead of ourselves here,
as we tend to do. Yep. The next page, though, as we move forward, we get the famous list of school supplies that Harry is going to need for his first year. This particular list is, I always find it to be incredibly interesting because there's a couple of like known like questions attached to it.
Yeah.
In one of the earliest printings of the book, there was a very famous misprint, which sort of marks some of the more collectible issues of the book, which is that under other equipment, they actually listed one wand as something needed twice. So it would say like one wand, one cauldron, one set of glass, you know,
yeah.
One telescope, one set of brass scales, and one wand.
And one wand. And yeah. Hey, wait, what?
Yeah.
Two one wands?
One wands. Immediately under that, we also have students may bring an owl or a cat or a toad.
Or a rat, I guess, if you want.
Yeah.
Ron.
Whereas Ron is breaking the rules. Like, I find it to be really funny that that's something that...
What's extra funny is that Percy gave him the rat. So Percy was breaking the rules.
Also, yeah.
Managed to become prefect anyway.
I know. Wow. So that's why is that overlooked? The other things that we have that kind of stand out to me a little bit are the inclusion of the textbook, The Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them by Newt Scamander.
Absolutely.
This one is always fascinating because you don't start Care of Magical Creatures until year three. And even in year three, there is a different textbook for that class.
Yeah. So it's like, why do they, in what class are they using Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them? Like, arguably Defense Against the Dark Arts, because like when Lupin's teaching them, mostly what he teaches them about is like dangerous beasts. So
I've always thought that too. Yeah.
Could be it.
Red caps and hinky punks and stuff.
Yeah. Either way, it's clearly also the first time you hear about the book Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which you know, goes on to become, you know, the movie, and we get to meet a lot more of Newt in the movies there. This is also the first time you hear about Bathilda Bagshot of A History of Magic, who it turns out is a pretty important character herself.
Yep. Adalbert Waffling, I believe, is another one of the characters that Dumbledore is supposedly having correspondence with before even leaving his time at Hogwarts. So that's just like a fun little Easter egg there where when it comes back up later, you're like, oh my gosh, like one of the guys he was talking to literally has a first year book that they need.
Look, if Dumbledore is the one making this list and he includes Adalbert Waffling and Newt Scamander and Bathilda Bagshot, it's almost surprising he includes Bathilda Bagshot on the list here, given his relationship with like Grindelwald.
That,
you know, because that's Grindelwald's aunt.
Yeah, that's
he
true.
Clearly doesn't have a very good relationship with her, but I guess she's, you know, they're not, you know, they're not all evil, obviously. Harry's parents are friends with Bethilda Bagshot as well, so.
That's very true. That's very true.
Yeah.
Let's see. So as we keep going forward, we make our way to the Leaky Cauldron, which I just wrote like a little note here because one of the fun things that we did when we were in our trip to London years ago now for the History of Magic exhibit at the British Library was we got to go to the physical location.
Yes, we did. This was so cool.
Because it's not really noteworthy all that much at all. Like, it's the type of place you might visit on like a Harry Potter films like walking tour of London or something similar, but it was just very interesting to like see the exterior of the place and then like look at it in the film and be like, wow,
well,
like,
we were there.
Yeah, we were there, but they like really change it for the film.
Yeah, but it is like it, I mean, the point of it in the book is that it's really innocuous and like muggles won't notice, and like sure enough in real life you won't notice.
Yeah, no, it's you could walk right past it and have no idea that it was like a place worth remarking over. So kind of just a fun little detail that I wrote down there.
Oh, this is another tiny little detail that I recently learned is that they're talking about walking past music stores, hamburger restaurants, and cinemas. Hamburger is a word that pops up in these first like five chapters like five times. Like the use of the word hamburger is there a lot, and then it is never used again. Like, it is an extremely muggle sounding word that came up a lot until Harry got to Hogwarts and then never again.
I know. Yeah. Which is just absolutely hilarious. Yeah. So yep. A little bit of inclusion of the word hamburger that's about to just go extinct for the rest of the series.
We also meet Tom, the bartender at the Leaky Cauldron, which is just one of those, like, it's like a throwaway character. You wouldn't think about it. And it's like, but the fact that his name is Tom is like specifically relevant to Voldemort choosing to not be called Tom Riddle.
Yes, because like what drives Voldemort crazy about the name Tom is that there are a lot of Toms.
Right. So this is an example of one of the, I think the example of the other Tom.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, realistically, especially because Tom Riddle is having a very similar experience to Harry in that he is eventually an orphan, you know, going to Diagon Alley. He goes by himself, and the first person he's likely to meet inside the wizarding world is someone who shares his name.
Oh gosh, he would hate that. I've never even thought about that. You're right. It's probably the first person he met.
Yep. Other than Dumbledore. Yeah.
Okay. So then this is another interesting thing is that everyone at the Leaky Cauldron, Hagrid doesn't say he's there with Harry. He just says, "I'm on Hogwarts business," and like taps Harry on the shoulder. And suddenly everyone's like, "Good Lord, is that Harry Potter?"
Right.
And it's like they all immediately know what he looks like, to which it's just like, how? How does everyone know what he looks like? I don't understand. No one's seen him.
All I can think, because I had the same note here, is that like, you know, like as Hagrid walks in, Tom is just like the usual Hagrid, and Hagrid's like, "Can't Tom, I'm on Hogwarts business." And it's like, if Hagrid is enough of a regular at the Leaky Cauldron for Tom to say like, you know, the usual, then it's entirely possible that Hagrid has known he would have this mission for a minute. And upon saying like, "I'm on official Hogwarts business," it's like, "This is Harry Potter. This is the one I was telling you about."
Yeah, that could be the case. Like, but like, yeah, I get, that almost makes more sense, because like, you'd think if this is the reaction and everyone just knows what he looks like, then the moment he gets into Diagon Alley, he'd be swarmed by everyone immediately. And yet it's like in the Leaky Cauldron, everyone recognizes him. Once they go into Diagon Alley, nobody recognizes
him. He does kind of get by. Yeah. He gets by. Too much.
The other thing is that like, this is sort of like one of those, like, it feels like it doesn't quite add up, but it could just be that. But when he's talking to Malfoy later at Madame Malkin's, it's like Malfoy is otherwise an extremely well-informed child per Wizarding World 11-year-old standards.
Sure.
Like, he normally has more information than Harry and Ron or Hermione usually have, just because his dad tells him everything. And yet Malfoy doesn't recognize Harry Potter in a world where people who haven't seen him do recognize him. And this is like the son of a Death Eater. So it's like, I don't know why he doesn't recognize him.
And what's especially interesting about that, and we'll come back to Leaky Cauldron in a little bit because he meets Quirrell, and we have to talk about that.
Yeah, we definitely talk about that.
One of the big things about Harry and his return to the Wizarding World, especially as you get like into the back catalog of information, like on Pottermore about like what's happening and like how the rest of, you know, like the Death Eaters and everything might be viewing him, is like, in a lot of ways, the Death Eaters were people who were looking for the biggest, baddest guy on the playground to like band together around to sort of like seek power around. And a lot of rumors were flying that like because Harry was able to take down Voldemort, that like it was very possible that Harry was going to be like the new second coming of the Dark Lord.
Right.
And so at this point in time, like, you know, everybody's kind of watching with bated breath to see like, you know, what does this boy end up doing? Like, what will he embody? And yeah, like how will he be relevant? And so especially through the lens of young Draco here, it has to be the case that Lucius like is very much aware of the fact that he has a child the same age as the Harry Potter. And it would not surprise me in the slightest if Lucius wasn't instructing Draco on his behalf to be like, look, there's going to be a kid in your class. You need to be like on him, like, you know.
Yeah. And like, sure enough, it seems like he does have the conversation with him like after this encounter, because then when Draco finds out that, you know, oh, it's true with the saying on the train, Harry Potter has come to Hogwarts. It's right. Like he is like on him like immediately, like, I'll be your best friend, Harry.
That's true. And yeah. And I mean, I think really what's most likely in this particular situation is that Draco is so self-absorbed and smarmy and awful that like I could see a world where he can't imagine that he's meeting somebody more important than himself.
Well, that's absolutely the case too. Yeah. I think he barely looks up at him. But anyway, back to the Leaky Cauldron, because sure enough, we meet a very important character, Mr. Professor Quirrell.
Yes. And this is like one of those really, really, really interesting ones, because like Quirrell is, I think, very strategically placed inside of the story to where like he has a lot of relevance, but Harry doesn't have a very particular relationship with him as a teacher.
Yeah.
Like, so we don't get like a lot of time between Harry and Quirrell, and it's like he's the first one we're really introduced to, and he like comes across as like so innocuous and non-dangerous.
Oh yeah, you meet him and then are immediately dissuaded away from him as like a threat at all.
Exactly. Yeah. There is one of the like the age-old questions attached to this particular exchange, which basically is, Professor Quirrell steps forward and says, stammered Professor Quirrell, grasping Harry's hand. Can't tell you how pleased I am to meet you. This is like one of those things where it's like, we know this story will culminate with basically the key thing that Harry has is that Voldemort can't stand to
physically touch Harry.
Physically touch him. So yeah. What it must tell us is at this point in time, Quirrell is already being impacted by the potential control that Voldemort will eventually have over him. But I also think because Harry doesn't have like the splitting scar moment either, and because they're able to physically touch, it must be the case that at this point in time, Voldemort is not actively occupying Quirrell's body.
I think that has been confirmed as well. You're right. Because you're right. Like if Voldemort was already possessing him, then he should not be able to shake Harry's hand without, basically losing it.
Yeah. I mean, like, at this point in time, like, Harry would accidentally defeat Voldemort 35 seconds into the Wizarding World.
Right. You know? Whoops.
Like, well, how about, and Hagrid would be like,
what do you know?
Who are you?
Right. Yeah. Like, whoa, wow, Harry. Really impressive. So basically, what's happened here is that Quirrell has met Voldemort. And in fact, the reason he's at the Leaky Cauldron and Diagon Alley at all on this day is because this is the day he is going to go personally try and rob Gringotts. So it is not actually a coincidence that he's there. He's there for that reason.
Yes. Yep. That, you're exactly right. It's a good point.
So there is that. They do shake hands. Voldemort isn't possessing him yet. Voldemort starts living on the back of his head because he fails to steal the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yes.
I believe is like the extended Pottermore explanation for what happens here. At which point Quirrell is, for like the duration of the year, a Horcrux.
Right. Yes. At least, you know, sort of like a stand-in Horcrux. We made a whole video about it once upon a time. But you're right. It's always one of those big questions. It's like, was Quirrell technically a Horcrux? And he is.
Yeah.
For a period of time, just sort of like unofficially one, because he's
like housing Voldemort Prime.
Yes. Yeah. We've always referred to like the consciousness of Voldemort as Voldemort Prime. And that is the one that is existing within Quirrell. So, it's a little bit different than like the piece that might be like in the diary for comparison's sake. As we move forward and enter Diagon Alley, there's the, three up, two across, which is the tapping of the bricks, to get into Diagon Alley. I just write that down as a bit of trivia. That's always one of those where
always
it's like
good trivia.
What is the pattern that you need to do in order to enter the Wizarding World? We've got the entrance into Diagon Alley, which is just like, honestly, this is one of those things that like if you've ever been to Universal, you know, and enter Diagon Alley. Like the way that they've designed the parks is so spectacular, and that like it's a pretty innocuous entry point into Diagon Alley.
It's so cool.
Yeah,
it's so cool. The first time we ever went, we were like on the Hogsmeade side of things, so we didn't quite get this reveal.
Yes.
Yeah, but oh my gosh, it will make you. It could make you cry walking in. It is so cool.
I tear up. I mean, I know, truly. It's like, yeah, it's like you're here, and it's amazing, and it's like it's so full and bustling. But it's so cool because it's like it's almost like Universal was willing to rely on the fact that people will figure out where to go. And sure enough, when you step through, it is packed.
Yeah.
Like nobody's not finding it. It's not a secret. Like everybody knows it's there.
Everyone knows it's there. But there's the night bus parked on the other side, I guess.
That's true. There's some.
You fell over for.
Classic.
Anyway, so now we're in Diagon Alley. We're walking down the street. I've made a note here that I think it's odd nobody recognizes Harry, but we already sort of talked about that. This is like one of those funny little anachronistic things where this book came out in 1997. Is that right?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah.
So the kids are looking through the window at the broomsticks and they're saying, "Oh, the new Nimbus 2000, fastest ever." And it's like, okay, that's a... Like, if you were alive in 1997, you were very aware that the year 2000 was coming soon. So everything was called 2000.
It was a really like common naming convention the time.
You can, for sure. It feels like it was written with that in mind. However, in universe, it's only the year 1991. So it's sort of weird that Nimbus called their broomstick the Nimbus 2000, especially because then in 1992, they're like, well, we may as well just 2001 it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or did you guys just found this company like 2000 years prior and now it's just lining up ever so slightly close to...
Man, that would be impressive. They just started just before they started the years. they're like 10 off.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, geez. We were founded in 9 BC.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Broomsticks actually outpace our calendar.
Yeah.
we get the really cool entry into Gringotts Bank, where you know you're getting to see like all the very clever goblins sort of like sorting and sifting through all the treasure. This as a kid, I loved treasure so very much. Like the idea of like the rubies the size of like coals and stuff like that. I'm just like,
what?
I want to be there.
Yes, I want to hold the jewels.
I want to hold jewels like that.
Right.
We learned about Vault 713.
Yep.
Which is the vault that
Sorcerer's Stone is in.
Yeah, the Sorcerer's Stone, Philosopher's Stone is stored inside of. One of the things that I did write down about this particular vault that I find to be interesting is that like it's very, very, very deep within the Gringotts vault. It's got to be like one of the more like original vaults for the school. But I do find it to be kind of interesting that like the only thing inside of it is the Philosopher's Stone, because almost certainly this vault has belonged to the school for a very, very long time. And it's almost like it's like curious to me, like, what are they normally keeping here? Like, because it's in this particular case, it's like, hey, we finally like we have a use for 713.
Yeah.
You know, but like in the meantime, is it just empty?
Yeah, I guess so. I have no idea.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. I also think the number itself, 713, it like stands out a little bit to me. I mean, right away, like the number 7 is lucky and 13 is unlucky. So it's sort of like an interesting pairing of those numbers together right there. That's but then true. If you write it backwards, it's 317. And I think like the way in Europe they write dates is with the day of the month first and then the month.
Yes, you are correct.
In which case, it would be 317, which is Harry's birthday.
Oh, that's so cool.
I know, which is so funny because Harry is the Philosopher's Stone, as we talked about back in Chapter 1. Although I need to issue a quick correction on the Harry is the Philosopher's Stone theory, where I've said I think that Sirius physically picks Harry up, hands him to Hagrid, who then hands him to Dumbledore. Sirius never picks up Harry in... when he's in the wreckage.
You're right.
Hagrid is there first. He fishes him out. Then Sirius shows up and says, "Give him to me, Hagrid. I'm his godfather." And he's like, "Nope, I'm taking him to Dumbledore. See ya." But it is still the first three characters who interact with him are Sirius, Hagrid and Dumbledore.
Good so, save.
There you
good
go. Yep, anyway. Yep,
there we go.
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pear Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Gryffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pear Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think, honestly, kids would love this because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
Through the Gryffindor is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. Y'all, I've got to say, I love international travel. I don't know if there's anything that opens your eyes and mind more to different walks of life than immersing yourself inside of new ones. But one hesitation I always have about going somewhere new is how to best navigate the differing languages. But that's where Rosetta Stone can help. Because for me, it's not just about like the fear of getting lost, although, to be fair, it's not a concern either. But to me, the immersion goes so much further than simply being somewhere else. I want to engage with and respect the locale by communicating in their tongue, not my own. And that's what's so great about Rosetta Stone. They provide 25 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, and more. And they use such an intuitive approach designed for you to pick up the language naturally, so you're really learning to speak, listen, and the one I always find the most fascinating, think in a new language. And what's even better is that when you sign up, it's for life. Yeah, a lifetime membership, because let's face it, we can only travel to so many new places, but so fast. But with all the time in the world, you can be ready for any adventures ahead. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Through the Gryffindor listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off your unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As we continue down to the vaults to get that precious Philosopher's Stone, there's just one line that I just found to be hilarious that never stands out to me, but I think is amazing. But they're seeing the stalactites and the stalagmites, and Harry says, "I never know like what's the difference between stalagmite and stalactite." And Hagrid says, "Stalagmites has got an M in it." I literally just wrote LOL next to it.
Oh my gosh. The actual difference is that stalactites hang tight to the ceiling and stalagmites might reach them one day.
Yep. Yeah,
that's my fourth grade. Shout out to Miss Hall. I drew a little diagram on my book.
Oh, that's amazing.
For which ones are which.
Oh my gosh. That's so great.
Yeah.
Let's see here.
Oh, this was something I didn't note. I underlined as I was reading through it. When they get to Harry's vault, which I feel like isn't Harry's vault number always like a trivia question we have to deal with? I feel like it is. I don't think it's mentioned in the book, at least not here.
You're right. I was like, as you were saying the 713 thing, I was like, oh, when you go it backwards, is it Harry's vault number? And I was like, No,
it's...
Do we know Harry's vault number?
I don't know all of a sudden. I was like, I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be here, but it's not. But anyway, what I thought was interesting was Griphook unlocked the door. A lot of green smoke came billowing out. And as it cleared, Harry gasped. Inside were gold coins, columns of silver, heaps of little bronze nuts. What is the green smoke?
What is the green
smoke? What is the green smoke in Harry's vault? Like, what protection did the Potters put on their gold? I want to know, because... It's never mentioned again.
It never is like, mentioned
why again. Is there green smoke in there?
Maybe they went and placed something in their vault, and then because it's been like 10 years since anybody's been to said vault, it just has rotted.
It feels like it's got to be the protection of some kind.
No, I agree with you. I feel like it seems like it's not dangerous once the door has been opened as well.
Yeah, so it's like...
So it's like...
Like, what? I mean, maybe if you were standing there and it like hit you, because I guess it doesn't touch them.
That's good. Good point. So,
but I don't know. Yeah. So I want to know. I'm trying to think of anything else in the Wizarding World makes a like green smoke.
Green smoke.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is like one of those strange when we talked a little bit about the colors associated with Harry. Like, you know, he's got like the red from Gryffindor. He has the red Expelliarmus, but then he's got like the green eyes in contrast with Voldemort's, you know, red eyes and green spell of Avada Kedavra and green from, you know, Slytherin and everything. So the green is always interesting whenever it's attached to Harry in any capacity. So there's, you know, worth keeping those notes in track. Yeah.
Don't know. This is where Hagrid also gives us the conversion rate between galleons, sickles, and canuts, which is bananas.
Yeah.
Still, I mean, seriously, if you were like, also just to get a single nut into a galleon is crazy, right? It's 17 times 29 nuts to a galleon.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, that's quite the
math I can just do in my head.
not so much, but I mean, like, you know, if you were to think about like, you know, transferring, you know, pennies to a $10 bill or something, like, I mean, that's a lot of pennies.
I mean, it's a lot of pennies. Yeah, but I could still tell you how many it took.
No, that's a good point. You know? That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the currency is just wacky.
There's
no two ways about it. Nothing costs what it's supposed to cost. We actually did just make an entire video where we broke down, like, if you were to take a galleon and just assume that it is the same shape and size as a British pound, and then we converted that that amount of gold into a weight, and then we cross-referenced the current value of gold with that weight, then like a single gold galleon would be worth approximately $1,400.
Which is crazy. I think in 1991 it was closer to like 300 or something, right?
Yeah, gold is really like skyrocketed over the past like 30 years.
Who knew? But yeah, in 2023, if a gold galleon is the same size as a British pound, then it is worth about $1,400 worth of gold.
Yes.
Which is, whoa.
I know, which is kind of amazing.
Harry is rich.
Harry is super, super wealthy.
Yeah.
Which I think is true kind of either way, depending on how you look at it. Speaking of wealthy, of course, then we go to Madame Malkin's where we meet Malfoy.
I guess we don't learn his name just yet.
No, we don't. But
he's just some annoying turd.
What's a good word to a turd is
just a real butthead.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is particularly interesting, and we just made a video again about this, is also the it's the early influence that Harry gets about the various houses.
Yeah, there's so much that could have changed about Harry's whole life without this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because it's really the conversation with Malfoy that ultimately leads Harry to asking Hagrid about the various houses.
Yep.
And upon asking Hagrid about the houses is when Hagrid explains that, like, you know, not a witch or wizard who's ever gone bad wasn't in Slytherin or something, which is always one of those like double, triple negatives that can never, like, I'm like, does that work? Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Also just not true.
But. Yeah, but also just not true. Yeah. Peter Pettigrew, anybody?
Yeah. Quirrell.
Yeah, exactly. I guess technically those have not been found out about yet.
So no, I guess there's that, but whatever.
But still, it's
Lockhart's
still,
already doing his thing, you know?
You know what? Hagrid believed that Gringotts was hundreds of miles under London, so it's safe to give a couple of passes and assume that not everything Hagrid says is always dead accurate. But where am I? Oh,
he believes Sirius Black is bad at this point.
True. True.
Yeah.
So
Gryffindor.
Gryffindor. There That's a good point. You got one. Yeah. Nailed it.
Nailed it.
Well done. The bigger point I'm trying to make, though, is that there's a big conversation when it comes to Harry's eventual sorting, which we're going to get to in a little bit. And it just sort of is like these early bits of influence on Harry as he, you know, kind of moves towards his sorting are vital, because it's really like what we'll ultimately learn from like Dumbledore. You know, it's our decisions more than our talents that define who we truly are. Like Harry asking the Hat not to put him in Slytherin is in part informed based on these two exchanges. And then there's one more with Ron that's yet to come. But the point is that like you never really know why the Sorting Hat is debating on Slytherin fully, or if the piece of Voldemort's soul that exists inside of Harry is any part of like that sway or not. But like realistically, it seems very close. Like unless what the Hat eventually is doing, and I feel like I'm getting way too far ahead of myself right now, but unless what the Hat is really trying to do is just explain to Harry like why Slytherin isn't a bad choice, it always reads to me like if not for Harry's request, he was going into Slytherin.
That's what it sounds like. Yeah. And this conversation right here was the basis. The one he's about to have with Malfoy was the basis for our entire what if Harry wasn't Slytherin. Like basically, what if Harry didn't meet Malfoy in Madame Malkin's, because that is when he first gets the information about Slytherin.
Yes. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. So these are actually pretty important conversations that are all happening, you know, like in terms of framing, you know, I mean, Harry at this point in time is building the basic foundation of his knowledge of the wizarding world. I mean,
yeah.
He's getting like, you know, he's drinking from a fire hose, as they say, like in terms of all this new information is just stampeding over him.
Yeah.
But, you know, as he's going forward, I mean, these are whenever you're into anything new, your first and earliest impressions are like,
yeah, lasting sometimes.
Lasting,
yeah.
Exactly. So,
it is a pretty big conversation that he has here. I picked up on this, and I was just like, it just really stood out as like a big detail, sort of. When he's talking to Malfoy, he says, "My father's next door buying my books, and mother's up the street looking at wands," which makes it sound, and it's possible that Narcissa is just looking at wands for herself or something. But if the way he phrases that, you know, Lucius is next door buying my books, it sounds like his mom is looking at wands for him.
That's how I read it as
right?
well.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, now that is a freaking giant detail right there, because if Draco doesn't go to if Narcissa just buys Draco a wand and he didn't go there and have the wand choose him, well, like that's a huge detail, because Draco's wand is part of the final battle, and its allegiance to Harry at the end is like a huge deal. So it's like, if Draco's wand didn't choose Draco, then Harry stealing Draco's wand from him shouldn't constitute ownership of the wand that Draco is the master of going to Harry.
Oh my, I can't, honestly, this is like one of those situations where it's like it is one of my least favorite parts of the entire saga is the explanation that Harry becomes master of the Elder Wand because he stole Draco's wand from him in a physical like fight.
Right.
Like some other time without ever holding it.
That's the back up a sec here. Right. So Harry eventually in Deathly Hallows steals Draco's wand from him physically.
Yes.
At that point, Draco has already become master of the Elder Wand because he disarmed Dumbledore with that wand.
Correct.
Right? Okay. So in Harry takes Draco's wand, all of a sudden he becomes master of that wand for having physically took it from him, which then also makes him the master of any other wand Draco was the master of. Which includes the Elder Wand. But if Draco didn't go to Ollivander's when he was 11 and have the wand that Harry stole from him choose him, then none of that math should work.
None of it should work. And the only thing I would say is that maybe Narcissa is just there like perusing chatting. Because we do know that the very next thing that happens is that Harry goes and buys books, and then they even go to Ilop's Owl Emporium before going to get the wand. So it is entirely possible that in the interim, Draco just goes and gets his wand.
Goes and gets the wand. Yeah.
Which,
it's totally possible. It's totally possible. I'm just it stood out to me because it's like, there's no reason to just go look at wands without the person who's buying the wand.
You're exactly right. Like, this is like one of those things that they're so personalized that it's like, it's not, there's no advantage to be there and perusing the shelves because like you have no idea what you're looking for.
Right.
You
have, yeah. You have no idea. You're not looking right for anything. You're just like, it's looking for you.
Yep. Anyway, we move forward just a little bit. We go into Flourish and Blotts for the first time where they get all their books. I did find it particularly interesting that one of the books that Harry particularly wanted was Curses and Counter Curses. That's something that I feel like eventually his affinity for Defense Against the Dark Arts, it feels like a natural fit.
Right, yeah.
You know, for what he'll end up doing. So it's just kind of fun that that's like who, like what he would have picked out.
Yeah.
Which Hagrid tells him he's not quite qualified to have yet.
I also love when he's talking to Draco. He like looks up and Hagrid's eventually standing there and he went and get ice creams. But like the reason Harry's in there by himself is because Hagrid tells him like, oh, I need to pick me up at the Leaky Cauldron. And it's like not like 2 minutes have passed. So clearly Hagrid goes into, or he sends Hagrid or sends Harry into the robe shop and Hagrid's like, I'm getting ice cream instead.
He said to pick me up. It could be anything he sees. Yeah. Like he maybe just changed his mind.
I guess so. I just think that's funny because he returns so quickly. He's just like, guess what I got?
Incidentally, the question about what type of ice cream that Harry has, chocolate and raspberry with chopped nuts, is a trivia question. I think I've missed like 11 times.
I literally wrote trivia gold right next
to
it.
I wrote trivia right next to it as well. Yeah. That's so funny.
Yep.
Anyway, we make it to the Ilops Owl Emporium where we actually don't get a name for Hedwig yet.
Nope.
This was something that I thought came almost immediately in the wake of the purchase of the Snowy Owl, but we do not get that. We do sort of have like a small allusion to one of the other like favorite theories that we've had here on the channel, which is that like because Hagrid lives such a simple life and because he is able to interact with so many like amazing raw materials, like unicorn hairs and or even potentially horns, which just like one paragraph earlier we would learn are worth 21 galleons each,
which seems like a steal if you ask me.
It really does.
I mean, because like a unicorn, according to Slughorn in book 6, a single unicorn tail hair could be worth 10 galleons.
Yes.
And it's like, on a single unicorn, there's got to be like hundreds of hairs, but there's only ever one horn.
Just the one horn.
And it's only barely worth twice as much as a single hair. Like either unicorn horns are just plumb unmagical, which seems silly to me because the horn has got to be the most magical part of a unicorn, right? That's the only thing making it not a horse.
This is a good,
right? Like the horn has got to be worth so much more.
That's the phrase of the whole episode right there. It's the only thing not making it a horse. It's a good point. It's a good point.
So anyway, I'd be. What I'm saying is, if it's me, I'm investing in these 21 galleon silver unicorn horns.
There you go. Good to know. And either way, my point I was going to make is that we've always sort of assumed that there's like some chance that Hagrid is just very quietly wealthy. Which when he goes to buy Harry an owl, which we know is kind of like a big ticket item, you know, for someone in the wizarding world. Like it's not like he went and bought him like, you know, an ice cream cone. He already did that.
Which already did do.
You know, he bought him like, you know, one of the most significant purchases that you can make. And even his own logic, he's like, you know, I don't like cats. They make me sneeze. Toads went out of fashion years ago.
Neville.
Poor Neville.
That is a slight, they're like, you don't realize it at the moment, but that is throwing Neville under the bus a few chapters from now.
It really is.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it's like when it comes down to these three, it kind of seems like anybody would pick an owl. Like
it does.
They provide like the most function. I mean, cats would certainly offer like a certain amount of comfort, which is not nothing. But like, you know, it just, I don't know. It seems Hedwig also offers comfort and is also useful.
There's also, exactly. It's just like, if you're coming in, if you're like a wizard or a witch, like what, there's nothing particularly magical about cats. I mean, I guess Crookshanks is like half Neasel.
Yeah.
So there is that. I guess you could argue that, but it just seems like that's such a muggle pet, you know? All the muggles have cats.
I know.
You know? Yeah. Not as magical. And then like it's not that toad, I mean, I don't know anyone who owns a toad. I'm sure certainly some people out there do, but we never learn anything magical about toads. Like they don't do anything that we ever learn of, which I wish Trevor the toad had ever done something fun.
Remarkable.
You know, besides trying to run away.
Yeah. In our saga about what if Neville was the chosen one, we did have it be the case that Harry has a toad.
Yeah. Named Hedwig.
Named Hedwig.
Yeah.
And is a golden toad and really awesome. Anyway, so moving on, we find our way into Ollivander's shop, which was founded in 382 BC. Just another fun trivia fact for you. So this company has been around for a very, very long time. So kind of remarkable in that regard. One of the things that I've always thought was really cool as like a characteristic to give to Ollivander is his absolute memory of every single wand and like characteristic. Like it's just such a cool like detail for Ollivander to have, because it's like I think it does speak to his just sheer affinity and love for the creation of magical wands.
Yeah.
Which I find to be really cool. We learn about both of his parents' wands.
There's like Easter eggs there too.
Yeah, there are. Yeah. So you want to do Lily's and I'll do James.
Yeah, okay. So he describes Harry's mom's wand as 10 and a quarter inches long, swishy, made of willow. Nice wand for charm work. So it sounds like, you know, what the Easter egg is that when he says charm work, it's a reference to the sacrificial love that protected Harry from dying.
Yes. Yep.
And
then additionally, we learned just a little bit about the father's wand, or James Potter's wand, which is a mahogany wand, 11 inches pliable, a little bit more power and excellent for transfiguration. This is just a kind of like early and fun nod to the fact that James ultimately ends up doing one of the most complicated transfiguration things you can in spellcasting, which is becoming an animagus.
Yep.
So just kind of neat that that detail is there from, you know, the very, very beginning. Gotta love that. You get the exchange with Ollivander where it kind of seems like he's like possibly scolding Hagrid a little bit. But once again, it feels like this is like one of those exchanges that suggests that like Hagrid's wand, if it was broken in half, is absolutely no longer broken in half. And Hagrid is very intentionally skirting the truth in his entire exchange, because it seems like Ollivander's like, but you're not using it, of course, right? Right.
Right.
And Hagrid's like, oh, no, of course. No, I would never do that. And
it's like, still got the pieces. There's so many things are weird about this whole exchange. One, he says, still got the pieces, though. And it's like, why would, if you broke someone's wand in half, would you just give them the pieces back? Like,
what? I mean, it's useless.
So, it's useless. I guess there's that. It just seems weird to return them to them. But even at that, he says his wand is snapped in half for having been expelled from school. And yet all of the Death Eaters in Azkaban, Sirius Black even, their wands are just intact. You know, like why are their wands snapped in half?
It does seem like one of the big challenges. And they even eventually kidnap Ollivander. And it almost even feels, I think that there's a couple of wands that he makes while he's captive.
Yeah.
But it almost feels like the plot related reason why you would kidnap Ollivander sooner is quite literally because like all of these Death Eaters would need wands. It does feel like this should be like a
right.
Like if you get sent to Azkaban, your wand should absolutely just be
right. Like they all need wands. That's the problem.
Yeah, if you're expelled from school and they do it, like absolutely.
Yeah, they can't go like buy you new wands or whatever.
Right.
So
The other really cool thing, or well, actually, before we get to the next cool thing, I would say is as he pulls his first couple of wands. Ollivander does that is for Harry, and one of them kind of stood out to me. It is Maple and Phoenix Feather, 7 inches, quite whippy. This is a ridiculously short wand. Like we know that Umbridge's wand is 8 inches, and it's like when it comes to wand lengths, they don't necessarily always speak to character unless they're extremely long or extremely short. In the cases of Hagrid, who needed something longer because he's a half giant, and then Umbridge, who it's like it's supposed to suggest that her 8-inch wand represents her like lacking of character.
Yeah.
So a 7-inch wand, like that is, it's like a really
it's
not,
real short.
It's a really short. It's like a twig. So I thought I just found that to be kind of interesting.
I know. I should have looked up what the wand would, or like what the meaning of the wand would was for that on like Pottermore, because you can look that sort of stuff up. That might have been interesting to know. 7 inches, it could be like him being like, oh, 7's the most powerfully magical number. Maybe Harry Potter needs a 7-inch wand or something.
Well, the thing that I do think is interesting about the wand that Harry ends up with is that it's Hollywood.
Yeah.
And
Hollywood. And he's famous.
And he's famous. It's like another one of those details. Nobody's ever confirmed to me, at least, that is an intended detail, but it feels like it's so funny. On the nose, but it's also like a remarkably American thing. So it's possible to me that it is just actual coincidence.
It could be. We also learned about Voldemort's wand, that it's yew, which I think yew is like traditionally the tree of death. Right?
Yeah, yep, yeah, that is correct. So, yep.
You know, sneaky.
Sneaky. And I think also like holly is a very commonly associated wood with Christmas, and Harry does eventually come back from the dead. So a little bit of,
yeah,
you know,
a little like Christ imagery there.
Just a tiny bit. Yeah. Yeah.
There's not zero of that in this story.
Right. I can't personally speak a whole lot to it. It's just I do think that there's some selections of the woods for all the various characters does end up having like obviously a rather considerable amount of meaning, and it is always very interesting to dig into what the characters have and how it's reflected in the wand description. So,
yeah.
gotta love that. We learn, of course, one of the most vital details, which is that Harry's wand, it's extremely curious in the eyes of Ollivander, because it has the same phoenix feather, or the phoenix feather that resides in Harry's wand has a brother, which is the only other feather given by the phoenix. And it was, in fact, obviously Voldemort's wand. I feel like I said that in the most like disjointed way imaginable. Yeah.
We learned that the feather in Harry's wand is related to the feather in Voldemort's wand.
Yes. And it's the only other one.
You and it's the only other one.
This is another one of those things where it's like, I desperately want more of this story, because what we'll obviously, again, go on to learn is that it's not just any phoenix, it's Fawkes the phoenix.
I know.
That like resides with Dumbledore. And we know in the Fantastic Beasts saga that there is a phoenix that Credence is caring for and is supposedly supposed to be the mark of Credence's like actual heritage
as
Aurelius Dumbledore. Yeah. And there's this like known characteristic of Dumbledore's that a phoenix will come to a Dumbledore in need. Which is, we dug into this, I have to imagine, deeper than
so
any
hard.
Other person like alive has, because we got through the end of Crimes of Grindelwald, which unfortunately is just kind of a tragedy of a movie. It was just very like disconnected. A lot of stuff doesn't hold up very well, and it's very complicated, but we worked so hard to find ways for it to make sense. But inside of that whole story is the predictions of Tycho Dodonis, which, oh gosh, I normally can remember it. Let's see here.
Despair of the daughter, return good Avenger with wings from the water. There's an opening line there too.
There is. Yeah. But you've got the gist of it at the very least. The big return great Avenger with wings from the water. There's a lot of big questions inside of the Fantastic Beasts saga about what that could be in reference to. Ultimately, we know that there's like the baby swap that happens at sea, and that there's a child who is ultimately lost at sea as a result. And, you know, it seems as if there is the return great Avenger with wings from the water, that what's happening is the baby who's lost in that situation is the one that returns to Credence later and is the very phoenix that he is looking after.
Right.
And so
that the assumption is, and we just don't know, is that phoenix is Fox.
Right. But that would also mean that Fox in some ways has this very unique heritage back to Corvus Lestrange, and the Lestrange family is not exactly noted for their like innate goodness.
Right.
So this is just like one of the, I feel like I'm deep in the weeds now, but like,
no, you are, but then there's another layer of this where it's like, that comes up with the Fantastic Beasts series that I just realized the other day. Like, another theory we had about that was that, when we learn about the brother wands, we see in Goblet of Fire that like what it means is that when they're forced to fight each other, they will form this like golden strand, and there will be a bead that appears between them, and you know, to like force them back and forth, and whoever wins, whatever. Like that's what happens in the graveyard when Harry and Voldemort are fighting. And we had a theory that Dumbledore's original wand was a brother wand to the Elder Wand.
Yes.
And that it shared a core, like a thestral hair from the same Thestral that gave its a hair to the Elder Wand. And then, like, I'll tell you what, Ben, in Secrets of Dumbledore, I did not realize it, but when Grindelwald and Dumbledore are dueling, that's exactly what happens. There is, like, a connection with a bead that goes back and forth, and Grindelwald is winning, and then Dumbledore shoves it back the other way.
Oh.
And I was like, I could not believe I did not realize that. I was like, oh my gosh, it looks like they're connected. And I was like, oh, I wonder, could it be possible they have a twin cord? I was like, oh, we made that theory. Oh my God.
It's like, we didn't even pat ourselves on the back.
I was like, how did I notice that?
Wow. It's amazing. Yeah.
Maybe we need to go back and visit that. Not that I feel like it matters, because I don't think they're making a fourth Fantastic Beasts movie, but whatever.
That's all right. Anyway, so as we close out this chapter, though, we get one of yet another hamburger reference.
I underlined it.
Which
the most muggle word.
The most muggle word imaginable. And this is always just like one of those things like where they go in and they're just sitting on like plastic seats and eating hamburgers. It's just like it feels like imagining Hagrid in that situation is like they've just left like the most magical place, you know, shy of Hogwarts.
Yeah.
And now they're sitting on plastic seats eating hamburgers. It's like nothing could go from like super wizarding hard turn back into the muggle world.
Yeah.
Other than that particular situation, which I think is kind of
kind of
interesting.
There's also a line down towards the bottom of this page where he says, I can't even remember what I'm famous for. And I think that's just a funny line because like he says he can't remember it, but then later on in book three, when the Dementors show up, he sure can then.
Well, it comes back to him. Yeah.
It does come back to him.
Like a resurfacing memory. So
it's like they unlock it. So not in a good way or anything.
But, right. Yep. Yeah. So I guess eventually you will remember it, Harry.
Yeah.
Is the point there. And then lastly, we kind of end with sort of like a rather mysterious little detail, which is just simply that like Hagrid is basically wishing him well, you know, he's going to go back to the Dursleys. And then sort of like Harry turns to look back at Hagrid. And like, as he does turn, Hagrid is just gone.
I wrote, there's no way Hagrid can apparate.
I wrote apparition question mark. Yeah,
there's no way.
Yeah.
First of all, you don't learn to do it until your sixth year, I believe, right? Yeah, because you have to be 17 or whatever to do it.
Yep.
So Hagrid would not have been old enough to do it. Two, there's a lot more of Hagrid to do the apparating, and it feels like the amount of density you are matters in apparition based on like eventually how they're describing it to you. And three, apparently he's not supposed to do magic after he gets Harry. So it's like he's not supposed to, like he wasn't old enough to learn how to, and at no point should he have been able to learn to do it or like allowed to learn how to do it. And even if he was allowed to learn how to do it, it feels like it'd be really difficult in particular for Hagrid to do it.
It does seem like he'd be facing
like I'm not sure how he vanished.
Yeah, maybe just his moleskin coat when reversed is an invisibility cloak.
Maybe he's borrowing the cloak.
He could be borrowing the cloak. Yeah. We know that Dumbledore has it at this point in time, although for it to be that close to Harry and not return to Harry would seem kind of like
come on, dude.
But the other thing is that we know that another way to make an invisibility cloak is with demiguy's hairs, mm-hmm. and which is something that we meet again, in Fantastic Beasts. But like, it's possible. What?
I was like, could it be like a disillusionment charm or something? I guess maybe.
I suppose it could be. I was just gonna say. I mean, we know Hagrid is really good with Fantastic Beasts,
so it's
entirely possible that maybe he has a demiguy's coat and was able to just like invisibilize himself.
I guess it'd be a lot of demiguys. They're not very big.
Yeah, that's true.
I like the idea that he had the cloak. That makes a little more sense to me because the cloak is like, you don't think about it, but there are times where like, it'll be like Hagrid or like Harry pulled the cloak out of his pocket. And it's like, if you can try and imagine like any garment you would wear that you would wear around your entire body, also being able to fit inside of a pocket is like, there is like a magical nature to the fact that the cloak is able to make itself really small.
Yes. I think that's true.
I think it could make itself big enough to cover Hagrid.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Like it almost seems like we never get like a whole lot of descriptions, but the invisibility cloak is regarded as, like one of the three most powerful objects that exist in the magical world.
Yeah.
The only thing I was going to say is that I don't have a lot of trouble assuming that the cloak could extend end, but we also know that at some point in time, as the Golden Trio get much larger, that like their feet often are exposed. Yeah, like, I know.
There is that too.
Yeah. But there's also the fact that like Mad-Eye can see through the invisibility cloak, which is like one of those things.
It seems like why?
Yeah,
it's like, I don't like that.
Right. Like the thing that it forces me to believe is that somehow Mad-Eye's eye is like of equal caliber.
Right, like there's more to it than we realize.
Right, right. Like you could almost have like a whole saga. Like I know that Grindelwald has like one like blue eye.
Yeah.
I've sometimes wondered, like, you know, did Dumbledore and Hagrid and Mad Eye all sort of have a role in like the downfall of Grindelwald, that like somehow, you know, like what Mad Eye received is...
I would love to have seen Mad Eye show up in Fantastic Beasts. That would have been sweet. Awesome. Like in his prime. Oh, that would have been a great... I don't know how old Mad-Eye is supposed to be when he's in the series, but that would have been awesome.
Well, maybe what they're going to do, because I think last time we were in that saga, we were still only in like 1931 and we're supposed to get to 1945. So one of my favorite like headcanon thoughts was like, maybe they'll just wait 15 years so that like all the characters are actually aged up 15 years. Yeah. And it's like, whoa, they really like went for it.
They went for it. Just playing the long game.
Commitment to the cause, apparently.
Exactly.
All right, Jay, before we close out here, we gotta discuss the chapter art.
That we do.
Five. Yep. What do you think?
I think so. It basically what we have here is a chair with a bunch of wands on it, and then a floating wand shooting a bunch of like magical sparks and stuff into the air. So I don't feel like the scene itself actually happens because the wand is floating by itself that's shooting the sparks. It does. I guess it's supposed to make you like wonder, like, "Ooh, is Harry going to get a wand in this one?" So that's kind of fun. I would say it's probably the weakest one we've seen so far.
Yeah, I feel somewhat similar. Like it's such an iconic one.
Yeah. For the amount of things that happen in this chapter, like why isn't Harry just holding a wand or Hedwig or a goblin or?
Right.
You know?
there is certainly a challenge, I think, associated like whenever constructing, especially if you're going to name chapters inside of a story.
Yeah.
I think that there's always a fine line you have to walk where you like chances are the title. And we have this like for thumbnails sometimes where it's like, you know, a lot of times you don't want to give away the prize in the teaser, you know, so it's like you don't want to give away all the information. You don't want to like show your hand. You want to like more like pose the question or something.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's, it's like, you know, if you showed a picture of a little boy, Harry, holding up a magical wand in this particular image, then it would sort of be like, oh, this is the one where he's going to get a wand. So it's like, I mean, it still certainly like suggests that like a wand is coming in this chapter.
Yeah.
But I think it does walk the line just like a little bit more carefully. So I could see where there's a little bit of like complicated feelings about like what to include,
yeah,
you know, in this particular one. I also wouldn't be opposed to seeing an image in this art style of Hagrid and Griphook and Harry in like a little...
Oh, in the cart?
Yeah.
That'd have been a good one because you'd be like, what? You'd have no idea what that is.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. So that'd be really great. So,
oh, we didn't talk about the introduced Griphook here in this chapter, too.
We didn't touch on that at all. Yeah. So Griphook obviously ends up being super relevant to the plot as we get to Deathly Hallows because he is literally the goblin that they like bargain with to get inside of the Lestrange vault and get Hufflepuff's cup. So,
yeah. Hagrid's like, don't ever deal with goblins here. And he's like, what about? He's like, this is the first one I met. I immediately didn't listen.
Right, yeah. Like, all of the advice that Hagrid gives before going to Gringotts is everything that Harry breaks in Book 7.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Also, just on this exact note, this is not related to Harry Potter, but I have to tell you, remind me to tell you later that I think Quoth can fly.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right. So, as we close out for the day, do you have a review for us?
A review? Oh, yeah. I was like, what of the chapter? Isn't that what we've been doing this whole time? Yes, I do. I have a review for us that we can read. Every week, we'll be trying to read a review from one of you guys about the podcast. So, this person didn't really leave their name. It just said AR1105. And it said, can't wait for more. Just finished the first three on YouTube. Can't wait for this to become my weekly routine. HP, after all these years, is still my go-to book when I can't sleep or have too much going through my head at night. And listening to the audiobooks has helped me a lot in the past 2 years. I read my first Harry Potter book, Book 2, when I was 12. And now, 23 years later, I still reread the books. I wonder where all of us will be in life when this whole series ends and the last line of the book is read. That is true. I picked this one because of that line. I was like, ooh, yes. Like, where where will my life be like 4 years from now when the podcast reaches the end of Deathly Hallows?
I know. No, it's incredibly interesting because like,
I'll have like a fourth grader.
Ooh, oh, that's crazy. Wild. It's like an arrow shot into the future.
I know.
And it's really interesting too, because the thing that stood out to me was just like the rereading of the saga. And like, you know, I think that throughout life, like that's sort of like what this story has done for me on so many different occasions, is that like, you know, you go through these like tumultuous and difficult times. And so often it's like being able to go dive back into like a familiar world with characters that you love, and like these themes of positivity and like openness and welcoming, you know, they're just like all, I don't know. It's just, it's such like a reliable world to go and get lost in and find comfort in. So, right.
And there's just always more to discover, which even like, I feel like I'm even discovering still now as we're doing this exact read through.
No, I know. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's like when you're like, we've certainly studied the books quite a bit, but I've never studied individual chapters of the story in the way that we are right now. So I'm having a really great time. I feel like it's completely sparking like brand new thoughts from like a theory crafting standpoint. Like, I think there's just going to be like a lot of really cool stuff that comes from it. So again, we just want to thank everybody for joining us, you know, in the journey as we kick off here. And again, you know, if you're happy to, you know, leave us a review, we would definitely very much appreciate it. And it might even be featured here in a future.
I know.
Episode.
Maybe we'll crack the top 50 by the time we record the next episode. That would be amazing.
That would be amazing. Oh my gosh. Fingers crossed. We'll see.
Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time through the Gryffindor.